The Green Front with Betsy Rosenberg, Wednesdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Turn it around. Can we continue to do what we've been doing for all these years and decades, business as usual, relying on fossil fuels, coal and oil and natural gas, and shunning other potential energy supplies? We're beginning to look at renewables, but with oil still spewing in the Gulf Coast, with all the problems we've had with coal mine tragedies lately, we certainly have, hopefully, have the attention of the American people right now, and we have to use that to really look at where does our energy come from, what are the costs of continuing our addiction to oil, and we're going to be discussing that today with two fabulous guests. By the way, I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg. I've been reporting on the Green Front Lines for about 13 years, beginning with my program EcoTalk, which was on the Air America Network. If you want to check out archives from that show, go to EcoTalk.net, and you can find archives from the Green Front on the Progressive Radio Network at greenfront.com. And welcome to the show right now. We're going to welcome Mike Tidwell. He is one of my favorite guests. I interviewed him in the wake of Katrina, so that was a little less than 5 years ago. And he had written a book 2 years prior to Katrina, in 2003, I believe, called Bayou Farewell. And he is really one of the nation's leading experts on the Gulf Coast, the area that is getting slammed yet again, as if it's not enough insult to withstand Katrina, Hurricane Katrina, of course. Now they're getting hit again in a whole new and different and dangerous way. And he's also the founder and executive director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. So in our first half hour, we're going to be focusing on the oil, can't even call it a spill, the oil catastrophe still unfolding just about a month after that horrible oil rig explosion took the lives of 11 people, injured others, and caused what is probably the biggest environmental disaster in this country so far. I don't know if it's been officially labeled that, but it's looking like that's what's happening, if it hasn't already. And then in the second half, we'll be speaking with Wade Crowfoot. He is the West Coast Political Director for the Environmental Defense Fund, getting EDF's reaction to the American Energy Act, the climate bill, as we're calling it, that was, I guess it's the American Power Act that was unveiled just a couple weeks ago. People have had a chance to look at it, almost all 1,000 pages of it. And different green groups are weighing in with some opposing views. So I want to get EDF's view, because they're one of the, I'd say, more moderate of the large green groups, and see what he has to say. But first, want to, again, welcome Mike Tidwell to the program, and thank you, Mike, for taking time. I'm sure this has been a very busy period for you. I know you've been all over the mainstream news, the networks, and that's great that the likes of Katie Couric are taking a half an hour to interview you about these problems. Again, having been on this beat a long time, I remember our conversation back then, and you were just passionate in your pleas to, you know, do something to save the bayous, the Louisiana marshlands and wetlands, which you say are, you said back then, were disappearing at a rapid rate. That was before Hurricane Katrina and before this oil disaster. So thanks for joining us, and how do you view what's happening now? I can imagine.
Well, thanks for having me back on your show, Betsy, and I'm a real fan, and I appreciate all your great radio work. It is a mess. I think the biggest problem with the Gulf oil spill right now is the level of uncertainty. It's just unclear how much oil is even coming out of that spill, out of that platform collapse, and it's unclear where it's going and when it's going to come ashore and what's going to be the final effect. But the idea that you could put that much oil, you know, something probably several times larger than the Exxon Valdez spill by the time it's finished, into the Gulf of Mexico without having serious impacts is, of course, impossible. It's just not going to happen. Tragically, you know, so many people who count on the coastal areas for their living are now paralyzed and are already paying the price for this oil spill. Commercial and recreational fishing has been shut down from the mouth of the Mississippi River all the way to Pensacola Bay, and now it's being expanded even further. You know, this oil could get into the quote-unquote loop current in the Gulf of Mexico, which would carry it to the Florida Keys and maybe even around to the east coast of Florida. You know, the tourists are staying away. I mean, it's a really, really, really big problem. But I think more than anything, this is a failure of U.S. energy policy. You know, the fact that we are so addicted to oil still, even as sea levels rise, even as we pay the cost in terms of national security, you know, even as hurricanes get bigger, even as oil spills, you know, we still can't seem to bring ourselves to let go of this dirty energy supply. And so this finally is a result of bad energy policy.
Well, I have heard you and others say that, bad energy policy. I wasn't aware we actually had an energy policy in this country. It has been so, you know, haphazard and changing with, changing political winds. And isn't that part of the problem, that we don't have, you know, a good long-term plan to get off of our addiction to fossil fuels and onto certainly many more renewable energy sources?
Well, we do have an energy policy in this country, and it's perfectly suited to the 1950s. You know, it's drill as much as you can, import as much as you can, use as much as you want, and don't worry about 10, 20, 30 years down the road. And that's
the
way
we'll subsidize you as well. And we'll subsidize you as well. And we, the government, will subsidize you as well while you do that.
That's right. And what we need is an energy policy that fits the 21st century. And, you know, one of the things that I've been trying to get people to understand about the Gulf of Mexico oil patch is Americans have no clue how many platforms are out there. I mean, we have in our mind a few dozen, maybe, you know, heroic platforms out there in the ocean with hard-hatted, hard-working men out there. But it's like another universe. It's like a space colony. There are 4,000 permanent structures, giant platforms in the Gulf of Mexico, and they tap collectively 35,000 different wells. I mean, if you look at the nautical charts of the Gulf of Mexico, these platforms, these oil platforms show up, and they literally look like stars in the sky. And they literally, coincidentally, group themselves into constellations so that boat captains that go out into the Gulf, they'll literally say, okay, I'm passing the bunny ears on my way to the barbecue pit where I'm going to rendezvous. I mean, literally, you navigate by the stars. There are so many platforms. And if you have that many platforms, that many wells, that much oil, sooner or later, you're going to get this kind of massive spill because you can't regulate away human error. Sooner or later, faulty equipment made by faulty human beings exposed to faulty judgment is going to lead to these sort of spills. And when you have 35,000 wells and a galaxy of platforms out there, sooner or later we got to ask ourselves, is this what we want, or would we rather invest in, for example, wind power? And near where I live, I now live in the Chesapeake Bay region, and we're trying to stop the governor of Virginia, who is obsessed with offshore drilling. He's been leading the whole charge for new offshore drilling in America. For what? For 6 days' worth of national supply is probably off the coast of Virginia. 6 days' worth. But it's going to take dozens of platforms, any one of which could have a spill similar to what we saw in the Gulf, and it would send an oil spill from Virginia Beach all the way up to Cape May, New Jersey, and all the way up to the mouth of the Potomac River itself. So you could either have 6 days' worth of national oil supply and all the risks that come with it, or, ironically, the Virginia General Assembly's own appointed expert panel on offshore wind power released a big report the same day the platform collapsed in the Gulf of Mexico, April 20th. The Virginia Offshore Wind Report was released that said that Virginia, using a small amount of its offshore water, you know, placing them away from naval installations and away from eco-sensitive areas, away from places where there would be a big visual impact, a small area of the coast, we could get 10% of Virginia's electricity from these offshore windmills. It would equal 3.6 million electric cars powered forever, or 750,000 homes powered forever. And guess what? If a hurricane were to blow through coastal Virginia and knock down some or all of those few windmills, you'd have 0 gallons of anything toxic. No pollution whatsoever. It's clean energy. So we can either have 6 days worth of oil and all the risks of oil spills, or we could have 3.6 million electric cars forever with no risk of pollution whatsoever.
Now I'm remembering why you and Ricky Ott were among my favorite guests. Dr. Ott was on last week, and you both are so knowledgeable and so passionate. And because your expertise is the Louisiana Bio, I do want to get back to that in a couple of minutes. But while we're talking about wind as an alternative, are you encouraged by the Cape Wind approval right in the midst of all this horrible news, the coal mine explosion, the oil disaster, and climate change legislation being stalled, being brought out again, and to mixed reviews? And we can talk about that if there's time as well, your opinion on the legislation. But
I am encouraged. What about Cape Wind? You know, again, that the Department of Interior gave the green light on the Cape Wind, Massachusetts offshore wind farm a week after the oil spill started in the Gulf Coast. Look, anyone who thinks there's an energy source anywhere in the world that's absolutely perfect, I mean, there's just not. I mean, hydropower has some problems. You know, nuclear certainly has lots of problems. We know all about the problems with oil and coal. And wind is not absolutely perfect, but it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be a lot better than the alternatives, because if we don't have wind, we're going to get one of those others. And, you know, beyond the visual impacts, look, there are some people who just don't want to look at them. They just don't. For whatever reason, they don't like it. Most people, however, most surveys show that most people don't find them offensive, you know, find them to be graceful and poetic or whatever. But the visual impacts, that, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholders. In terms of environmental impacts, two major environmental impact studies for the Cape Wind Project in Nantucket Sound found no meaningful impacts to ecosystems whatsoever. And, you know, again, if there's an accident and one falls over, you don't have any kind of oil spill or anything. So I wholeheartedly support offshore wind. I especially support offshore wind that's off the coast far enough that, you know, it doesn't dominate the shoreline. And I think it can provide a lot of electricity for this country.
And just to comment on that, your beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, part of the problem, is it not, that Americans still don't see solar panels and wind farms as a beautiful thing and a sign of the future and our transition to a cleaner energy future? I think if there was more appreciation for that aspect, they might not be quite as quick to, you know, condemn. We happen to live on the water, on the shores of the San Francisco Bay, and a friend was visiting a couple weeks ago, and he said, well, you wouldn't want wind farms right outside. I said, well, not right outside, but a couple, you know, maybe a quarter of a mile off where I could see them. Absolutely. It's mm-hmm. a sign of progress, a badge of courage, and I think we have to get more people to feel that way, or we're never going to really embrace the alternative technologies. But that's another conversation for another day. Let's get back to the poor Louisiana coast. I mean, it almost feels like they're, you know, the American version of, you know, Haiti. If they've been hit so many times, and as a people, their will and their desire to survive and thrive is so strong. The only thing that is as strong is their bad luck in the weather department. And tell us, because you know this area so intimately, what is probably happening as we speak in terms of damage to the marshlands, the wetlands, the fisheries, the shrimp farms. It's such a rich area. And you were talking about the number, the huge number of wells and platforms out there. Approximately what percentage are there in the Gulf of Mexico, and why are they so, you know, they're located so close to this rich coastal area?
Well, in my book, in my book, Bayou Farewell, which, as you mentioned earlier, came out in 2003, it predicted the Katrina disaster. And I also spend a lot of time in the book out on the oil platforms and getting to know the oil industry and also describing the dangers and potential problems of the oil industry. Basically, there's tons of oil in the Gulf of Mexico because of the, you know, just millions of years of deposits from the Mississippi River and previous river systems that flowed into that region and bringing lots of organic material that then was deposited, sank, you know, reach the right pressure level and all the different geologic processes that create oil, and there it is now. And so you see lots of platforms right off the mouth of the Gulf of Mexico, the Mississippi River in the Gulf of Mexico. The oil industry itself, as I describe in my book, Bayou Farewell, has done a lot to destroy the integrity of the coast in many ways. Now we have the threat of oil coming on shore and killing the marsh grass. But for years and years and years, there was lots of oil activity in the marsh. So there was a lot of oil and gas wells in the marshlands of South Louisiana. And to get to that oil and gas, the industry scissored about 10,000 miles of canals and channels so their boats could get into the marsh. And those canals and channels, once dredged, don't go away. In fact, they erode and they widen. They like double in width every 11 to 12 years. So, there's been an area of land the size of Delaware has turned to water in South Louisiana since World War II. And about a third of that is just because of the dredging from the oil and gas industry, the erosion caused by all those boats and dredging. The other two thirds is because the land is sinking, and it's sinking because we put levees on the Mississippi River, and the river can no longer flood and redeposit its nourishing alluvial soils, and so the land's just sort of withering away. But the final impact on the people, the Cajun people who live there from all of the above, is their culture is disappearing. You know, the marsh is disappearing around them. As the marsh disappears, you have less wildlife, you have fewer shrimp, fewer crabs. More and more people have been forced to stop shrimping and crabbing and work for the oil industry and work further and further offshore, because now they're having to drill deeper and deeper water. And so people who used to be with their families all the time, Cajuns love their families, you know, shrimping together as a family, a father and his sons, or crabbing and you know, living in their camps in the marsh together as families. Now the men are separated from their families for weeks and months at a time, working for anonymous oil companies in a dangerous habitat, literally miles and miles from home, like being in outer space. And meanwhile, the coast itself is disappearing, the marshes being eroded, and now the oil is coming on top of that, which will further destroy the marsh. So it's already an ecological calamity, and it's had huge impacts on the Cajun people.
And you say it's disappearing at an astonishing rate. Give us some numbers just to give people an idea.
Well, an area the size of Manhattan, I mean, imagine all of Manhattan Island, that much land is erased from South Louisiana every 10 months in Louisiana. That's about 50 acres a day. It's an area of land, as I said before, about the size of Delaware since World War II. Literally marshland, barrier islands, and dry land that's all been converted to water. Basically, the marine zone of the Gulf of Mexico is moving north. The Gulf of Mexico is moving north, closer and closer to New Orleans as a result of this land disappearing. And that's why you saw such an enormous surge tide from Hurricane Katrina. I mean, that storm came ashore with a 30-foot surge tide and stayed, you know, was well over 20 feet by the time it hit the outskirts of New Orleans. That's the biggest surge tide ever recorded in the history of North America. And it's in part because, you know, the fingerprints of climate change, the fact that hurricanes are getting bigger, is clearly all over that storm. But it's also that the shoreline itself is so eroded, so wounded, so crippled, that there's very little to stop that rolling tide of water that comes from hurricanes from seeping into places like New Orleans. So you've got multiple problems. Look, South Louisiana is a mess. I love the region. I love New Orleans. But the reality is New Orleans is the most dangerous city in the world to live in. And what does New Orleans need to survive? New Orleans needs a lot. It needs better levees. It needs restored wetlands and barrier islands. And it needs an end to global warming. And that last thing, an end to global warming, means an end to oil drilling. Because the oil drilling, the use of oil, is what's driving so much of the global warming.
And I recall in the wake of Katrina, as President Bush and other members of the administration were saying, well, this disaster that drowned New Orleans, which, by the way, that's an eyesore, not a windmill or wind farm, you know, to most people
right.
who are tuned in to our environment. They were saying this could not have been predicted. This could not have been foreseen. And yet you predicted and foresaw this, and it's spelled out in your book 2 years before Katrina hit land.
Yeah, I mean, look, Katrina was a man-made disaster. There's no question about that. I mean, and it was clear that she was coming. I mean, I first stumbled on the story of pre-Katrina Louisiana in the late 90s as a newspaper journalist, and hung out with Cajun shrimpers and crabbers who basically told me in the late 90s, Katrina's coming, Katrina's coming. I mean, they didn't know what to call her then, but they said, look, our land is disappearing, storms are getting bigger. It's only a matter of time before we get whacked. And I was amazed that more people in the country didn't realize that this was the fastest disappearing landmass on Earth, that all of South Louisiana was turning to water, that our biggest port in the country was vulnerable, that so much of our energy infrastructure was vulnerable, that the great culture of the Cajun people and the great traditions of New Orleans were on life support. So I wrote this book, Bayou Farewell, The Rich Life and Tragic Death of Louisiana's Cajun Coast. And, you know, it came out, as you said, 2 years before Katrina. And the reason I was able to write the book and to declare that this was already happening is because it was obvious. It was obvious to anyone paying attention that this was a fragile, vulnerable coastline. And frankly, tragically, nothing has changed. Even after Katrina, the country has improved the levees somewhat around New Orleans. The levees are better, but the idea that New Orleans is protected from hurricanes is absurd. The barrier islands and wetlands have not been restored, and they can be. Bobby Jindal, the governor of Virginia, of Louisiana, is now talking about an emergency barrier island construction process that he's trying to get BP to pay for, but it's the jury's out and whether they can do it in time to keep most of the oil out of the coastline. So, you know, when you don't plan to do better, when you don't have a committed vision to improve and protect the environment, then you wind up having chaos and half-hearted, a dollar late and a dollar short sort of efforts. And that's what we're seeing in Louisiana right now.
Have you been down there since this disaster began unfolding a month ago?
I am going down to Louisiana tomorrow. I will be down there tomorrow, and I have not been down there since it happened. I've been in touch with many of my coastal friends who, depending on where you are in Louisiana and much of coastal Louisiana, if you drop a shrimp net in the water or a recreational fishing line or a commercial fishing line in the water, if you lower a crab trap in the water in coastal Louisiana, you get a $10,000 fine from the State Wildlife Service, because those waters have been declared unfit for fishing, and these people who have lived their whole lives by crabbing and oystering and shrimping and now are fined if they do, you know, their historic work that their families have done forever. And it's tragic and heartbreaking, but that's what's happening because of the soil spill.
Tomorrow being May 20th, which is the one-month mark since the explosion, and then, of course, on Earth Day, of all things, the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, the Deepwater Horizon sunk. And I'm sure, isn't it hard to believe that a month later it's still spewing? I mean, slightly less, you know, the rate is a little bit slower with this straw suction thing they've put in there, but it's still unfolding. I mean, every time I see those pictures of that oil, you can't even call it a spill. I mean, Michael Brune, the executive director of Sierra Club, said his son spills his milk. You know, this is not a spill, so I guess we should come up with another term for it. But catastrophe, disaster, it's still unfolding. And that's what's so heartbreaking, that we don't even know the beginning of the impact, really, yet that oil is still moving, you know, through the currents. And you know, may not have hit land in as much a mass as had been feared yet, but this is on the surface. We've got a lot more going on underwater, and so the impacts are going to be felt. You know, Ricky Ott talked about the impact still being felt from the Exxon Valdez 20 years later.
Well, you know, this is because of our addiction to oil. we have methodically exhausted all the oil that's easy to get to. All the oil that's easy to get to on land, all the oil that's easy to get to in shallow waters off our coastal areas, gone, gone, gone. Already used it up or almost depleted it. Now we're having to go into deeper and deeper water. That's why you see rigs that go through a mile of ocean depth, then hit the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico and go another 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 feet under the bottom of the ocean floor. And that is risky, risky, risky stuff. And now, as everyone in America has seen, when there's a blowout a mile below the surface of the ocean, your ability to do anything about it is the equivalent of trying to stop an oil spill on the moon or in outer space. I mean, this is an environment completely hostile to human beings. It's freezing cold. It's pitch dark. It's fraught with, exotic technology that human beings have designed to take the place of human beings, and it's fraught with problems. And that's what struck me, is seeing these videotapes of these efforts of robots to stop this oil spill. It literally reminds you of activities on Mars, like the Mars rover and that type of technology. And the point is this. You know, if we want to continue to go deeper and deeper to get our oil in places like this, we have to understand that there are going to be blowouts in the future, and they're going to be difficult to stop because the environment is so hazardous and so harsh and so alien to human presence that this is going to happen again. So if we don't want that to happen, we need to get off of oil. We need to switch to something other than oil. Otherwise, we're going to be drilling in 2 miles of water, 3 miles of water, and it's just going to get more exotic, more costly, more freaky, and harder to control.
Maybe next time they'll spend $500,000 on a blowout protector, sort of a safety valve that they passed on, even though I guess European nations insist on it. What is it about we Americans where we are so trustful of industry leaders who say, don't worry, this will never happen, can't happen? Okay, I mean, at least our politicians, go along with that. And they've been, in bed and had a really cushy deal for all these years. Do you think this disaster will change that? And then my last question is, how might this impact the climate legislation that is pending as we speak?
Well, the Gulf oil disaster has already had an effect on the regulatory environment. I think to President Obama's credit, he's moved quickly on this. He's already, declared that the Minerals Mine Service or Minerals Management Service under the Department of Interior, which regulates offshore drilling, is going to be rearranged and reorganized so that the part of the service that regulates oil safety will not be the same part of the agency that takes in royalties from those, lucrative royalties from those same companies. So there's no conflict of interest there. So changes are already happening. I think they're appropriate. God knows if this had happened under the previous administration, we wouldn't have seen as much change as fast as we have in all likelihood. In terms of the climate bill, I've not been a fan of what's been happening on Capitol Hill in terms of climate legislation. I was not a big supporter of the Waxman-Markey cap and trade bill that passed last June. I much prefer a bill that's been introduced by Senators Maria Cantwell of Washington and Sue Collins of Maine, one a Democrat, one a Republican, called the cap and dividend bill, where you would cap carbon emissions and simply make all polluters pay, take that money, and give almost all of it directly back to Americans as a monthly dividend. I think that's the inevitable way we're going to solve global warming in this country, and it would cause energy prices to rise, but three-quarters of all Americans would break even or come out ahead with their monthly dividend. But that's a source of another conversation. What seems to be that the leading bill in Capitol Hill right now, the Kerry Lieberman bill, which they don't want to call cap and trade, but has, a lot of problems, I think. It does try to capitalize on the offshore drilling issue by allowing, for example, neighboring states to to states that might want to drill to have some sort of veto power. I'm not sure that that... I think the consensus on Capitol Hill is that the oil spill has actually made it harder to pass anything on climate, as if it weren't hard enough already, has made it harder. I think Senator
I read that
it might. Yep.
I read that analysis and I was really depressed. Oh my goodness! And that of course is because of the political horse trading that goes on.
This country's still in denial, basic denial about climate change. I mean, the whole, on the East Coast when we had this, our weather was unrecognizable this winter, totally unrecognizable. Record precipitation, record snowfall, and the fact that many people took that as evidence that there was global cooling happening instead of global warming. That's where we are as a nation, or many people are, and we're just not ready, it seems, to take this issue on directly and get out of our denial. But trigger events will happen. The Gulf oil spill, Katrina, there are going to be more trigger events, and there's going to come a point when this country is going to get serious. The only good news, I think, is that historically our nation, Winston Churchill said, Americans can always be counted on to do the right thing after exhausting all other possibilities. And, I think we're running out of options. And our denial on climate change is quickly doomed to run out soon. And then I think we're going to change explosively and very quickly. The question will be, will we have done it in time?
Yes, and maybe if we can get the likes of Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity off their, hot air about how this is, the Sierra Club triggered this explosion, and they were the ones leading the cry about what global warming when it was so cold and snowing on the East Coast. That kind of ignorance is dangerous because they have a huge audience, and people seem to want any possible excuse to not be concerned about climate change. So part of the problem is with the media, but that is a topic for another day, and it's my favorite topic. But I want to let you go. Mike, really appreciate your taking time to speak with us on the Green Front. Are you working on a sequel to Bayou Farewell? I can imagine what it might be called if it was Bayou Farewell back in 2003.
Well, not yet. I'm thinking about it, and we'll see. There might be another book, but right now I'm like you, just trying to get the word out, trying to help the country learn the right lessons from these different crises, and let's get moving toward clean energy.
Thanks so much. We've been speaking with Mike, Executive Director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. Didn't even have time to talk about that, but we'll have him back next time. And the author of a seminal book back in 2003 called Bayou Farewell, which predicted some of the devastation that we saw when Katrina hit with the shoreline not shored up with the natural marshlands, wetlands, and the levees in disrepair. That happened, and here it is 7 years later, and another devastating blow to that rich source of marine life, and that is the Louisiana coastline being hard hit by this oil disaster unfolding. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be switching gears slightly, but going deeper, so to speak. I won't say drill down. No, I won't. Into the Carrie Lieberman climate bill. We'll get some reaction from the Environmental Defense Fund's West Coast political director. You're listening to The Green Front. I'm Betsy Rosenberg. We'll be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network. Thoughtful, provocative, cutting edge. The Ask Dr. Eisenstein Show.